The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Well, Iran was one of the early cases of outbreak.
Unfortunately, Poland is doing far fewer tests than other countries.
So Italy now has been reported over 74,000 people in total.
The virus is starting to spread in the UK.
One of the things that is so telling in South Africa is that we have many South Africans.
Right now, I'm in Seoul, Korea, where my family lives.
The Chinese authorities have reported over 80,000 infections in China.
I'm a bit worried that Russia's not doing enough.
I'm Jacob Schultz, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 28th, 2020. As the coronavirus pandemic spreads across the globe, it can be difficult to keep track of how the virus has spread and how different countries have responded. So this week, we're doing something a little bit different. We're bringing you dispatches about how 9 different countries are handling the coronavirus outbreak. I spoke with experts about the situations in Poland, Spain, South Korea, Italy, Russia, South Africa, Iran, China, and Great Britain. You'll hear from journalists, Brookings experts, a former CIA officer, and a member of European Parliament. What are the restrictions different governments have put in place? What legal authorities have they relied on? How has COVID-19 and the corresponding government response affected life in each of the countries? We begin with Amanda Sloat, Robert Bosch Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, who's written on the general differences in global responses. Then we'll move on to our country-by-country dispatches. One other quick note. Unlike usual conversational Lawfare podcasts, here we wanted to bring you just the experts' voices. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 527, Coronavirus Around the World.
I'm Amanda Sloat. I'm a Robert Bosch Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution and am calling from home here in Washington, D.C. During the first week of working from home, I occupied myself by reaching out to a large number of friends who were living, working, and traveling overseas, and heard back from over 90 people in 68 different countries. And what I found is that there's a lot of similarities in how we're responding to coronavirus. Everybody is social distancing. They're working from home, and there is panic buying. But I also found that people in different countries are weathering the crisis in very different ways. For example, they're hoarding different things. They're passing time in different ways. And interestingly, they're also worrying about different things and they're blaming different people. One of the big commonalities, at least across the Western world, is that everybody tends to be hoarding things. Now, on toilet paper, the hoarding is very common within the Western world. But interestingly, once you start to get to parts of the Middle East and Asia where people use bidets, they think the Western obsession with toilet paper is somewhat crazy. People are also tending to hoard medical supplies, hand sanitizers, and other cleaning products. In some countries, they're even ripping them off the walls of doctors' offices or using vodka, eau de cologne, or other more creative means of sanitizing their hands. There was another large divide over masks. In the United States, many people are adhering to doctors' wishes to preserve them for medical professionals, or they simply can't find them in shops. In Asia, for example, a large number of people wear masks, although that's something they were already doing anyway, given the air pollution in many of their countries. Interestingly, an Indian friend told me that a temple had covered its idols with masks to protect them. In Lebanon, a friend said that some women were wearing masks to cover up their lips so they didn't need to get Botox refills. Now, if you move to places like Africa, they tend not to stockpile food. In terms of how people were responding to the crisis and entertaining themselves, here is where you see real cultural differences. The Finns tend to be very introverted by nature, and so the joke there is that this is a crisis that was made for them. In places like France, people were finding it very difficult to stop kissing one another. In Argentina, they were finding it difficult to stop sharing mate with one another. Everybody in all sorts of countries seems to be making live streams of people doing ordinary things at home, singing from balconies, making videos of themselves cooking and dancing at home. I also looked at how people were responding to this crisis in conflict zones. And interestingly, almost every group seems to have something to say about this. The Taliban was tweeting assurances to international health organizations about their readiness to coordinate on coronavirus response. And even ISIS issued a newsletter with health instructions quoting Quranic verses on washing hands, avoiding affected areas, and interestingly told its members not to travel to Europe for terror attacks given the pandemic there. The other striking thing is that people all around the world are maintaining a good sense of humor, with all sorts of memes, jokes, and videos appearing online. Governments have largely been imposing similar types of constraints in terms of encouraging people to maintain social distancing. There's starting to be reports out of Africa, for example, that this is simply difficult for people to do given the nature of how they live. But in many other countries, this is something that governments have imposed. One thing that has been fairly universal is that people tend to find it difficult to police themselves, and so they will continue to gather and socialize with friends. In Ireland, for example, there was a close the pubs hashtag that started going viral on Twitter after people were seeing images of people celebrating St. Patrick's Day the weekend before the holiday, leading the government to actually require all pubs to close the following day. In some countries, like Serbia, they have imposed a state of emergency, and they're actually deploying the army on the streets to ensure that people comply with the curfew, including those over 70 who are no longer allowed to go out. In some other European countries, like Italy and France, the government is requiring people to make auto certificates, essentially to print out pieces of paper at home indicating where they live, where they are going, and why they are going out. There have also been debates in some countries about whether or not governments are taking surveillance measures too far. In Israel, for example, the government has been using cell phone data to track where people who are supposed to be in quarantine actually are to ensure that they are complying with the restrictions. And in South Korea, the government is also using cell phone data as well as other surveillance video and footage to put online where somebody who has tested positive has been. So interestingly, some of these government responses are starting to raise real questions about civil liberties and how much of their privacy people are willing to give up in the name of a health protection. Here in the United States, there have been debates about whether or not it's safe to hold Democratic primary elections. This is also a debate that people are having across Europe as local, regional, parliamentary, and presidential elections have been scheduled. Interestingly, the British government, which has in many ways been a laggard in terms of its response to coronavirus, was the first out of the gate in terms of making decisions about its local elections, which are scheduled for England on May 7th. The government actually announced a one-year delay to those elections. France and Germany both had elections scheduled that went forward. France had local elections on March 15th, and Germany in the state of Bavaria had elections for that area scheduled on March 15th. Interestingly, in France, the government imposed stricter measures the day before the elections, which led to some criticism about whether or not they should be held. In Germany, the government imposed stricter nationwide measures the day after these regional elections were held. Now, both places need to have runoff elections in a number of cases. In France, the government has decided to postpone the second round of elections. In Germany, the government has decided to hold all of the second ballots via postal ballot instead. So similar situations and yet different responses to the second round. Italy, which of course is really suffering with coronavirus at the moment, was scheduled to have a constitutional referendum on March 29th. They've made the decision to postpone that referendum. Coronavirus is raising a huge number of questions that are interesting both anthropologically and also politically. We are seeing very real debates about civil liberties and how much privacy people are willing to give up in response to health protection. This is somewhat similar to debates we had in the United States after 9/11 and conversations we had with the Europeans in terms of the debate over data privacy and civil liberties when it came to tracking foreign fighters, for example. We've seen some conflicts between church and state in countries like Greece. We're seeing questions of racism in terms of how people are responding to where the crisis is originating and what that means in terms of the response. Within the European Union, we so far have seen nation states, member states, as the first point of contact to try and resolve this crisis, even though coronavirus does not respect borders, and many people are increasingly calling for a EU-wide response to this. So I think a lot of things are going to be affected by the way citizens relate to their governments, whether governments become much larger, assume more powers, assume a much more active role in the economy, in terms of how countries relate to one another in terms of responding to crisis, how authoritarian regimes respond to this, how democratic countries might develop more authoritarian tendencies to try and manage a response to this, and where this leaves the world once this pandemic has passed.
Hello, I'm Radek Sikorski, member of the European Parliament, chairman of the EU-USA delegation in the Parliament, formerly Poland's Minister of Defense of Foreign Affairs and Speaker of the Lower House of Parliament. Unfortunately, Poland is doing far fewer tests than other countries. The virus got to us after it got to Italy and Germany. The first person diagnosed in Poland had come from Germany. So we are behind the curve, which is just as well, because that gives our health system a little bit more time to get into gear. The most spectacular measure was shutting down the borders, and it was done without coordination with the rest of the European Union and without making exceptions initially for people wanting to transit through Poland. So huge queues of several, up to 60 kilometers in length of trucks from Ukraine, Belarus, Baltic states built up for about a week. Then it was relaxed so that transit is now allowed through Poland. And Polish citizens are being shipped back to Poland from abroad. So my son, for example, who was in Baltimore at university just before the blockage of flights, we gave him half an hour to get to the Baltimore airfield. And he got on to, we think, the last flight to London and then one of the last flights from London to Berlin. And the Polish border was already shut, so he took the train to Frankfurt on the Oder and then walked across the bridge with me picking him up on the other side. So it was like a spy exchange from the Cold War. The epidemiological use of closing down borders is questionable, but it is popular. In a crisis, people want to see that the government is doing something, something decisive. In Poland, we have several stages of extraordinary situations, emergencies. This is the state of epidemics, which means that, for example, I got a written order from the government, from our local epidemiological station, to be confined to my house for 2 weeks under the penalty of 30,000 zlotys, which is about $8,000. And the police either call or come in person every day to make sure that I'm inside. But of course, we are wondering whether our presidential elections, which are scheduled for May, can happen. And this would require triggering other aspects of emergency laws as provided in the Constitution. The ruling party in Poland actually shut down most of the opportunities for voting by mail. But the leader of the party now says, it's no problem. We can carry out the vote. But 70% of the population seems to think otherwise, that it would create a huge hazard. But of course, the problem that the ruling party has is that during this health emergency part of the crisis, people tend to rally around the current authorities. But by May, we might have an economic crisis on our hand, and then the political situation may start to change. So they would like to ram through the presidential election because that maximizes their chance of winning. Poles are very disciplined in a crisis. Telephone companies have done surveys because, of course, they can track where people's phones are. And using mass data, you can make a map, and they have, of how different populations behave. And it turns out that Poles stay put, whereas the Italians and the British move much more. That's, I think, because the Italians have their cafe culture and the British have their pub culture, whereas Poland's social life is much more family-centered. The Interior Ministry has fielded an app which you can download, which then gives the police your exact location, so that can spare you the pleasure of daily visits by the police. But I'm not using it because Poland subscribes to the Pegasus software of total surveillance, and I suspect I'm one of the subjects, so I think they know where I am already.
I'm Alex Finley, calling in from Barcelona, Spain. I'm a writer, a former CIA officer. I've written two satires about the CIA and a number of articles in various media outlets. So we've mostly seen here the same pattern that you've seen everywhere, which has been very strange because I moved here from Italy last year. It's exactly what we experienced here. So it really is useful to be looking at the people who are 10 days ahead. So we saw what was happening in Italy. We kept thinking, well, that must be coming here, right? And sure enough, it was. So when it hits, I think it hits really fast, which people don't quite grasp. I think conceptually you maybe understand it, but when it happens fast. So you have, oh, there's 2,000 cases, but it's isolated. Oh, there's a cluster there, but it's isolated. But very quickly, within a few days, nothing is isolated. It's the whole system is sort of overrun by it. The perception is it's definitely still growing. We went into lockdown and people again are still sort of looking to Italy to see if their measures have started to bend their curve and hoping that we'll have the same here. The problem, particularly with a Mediterranean lifestyle, is it's hard to convince people not to go out, particularly the Spanish, of course, love to gather at night and eat tapas together and hang out at the bars. And the weather here in Barcelona is always so nice that people are just out all the time. So when they put in place the lockdown, people didn't quite take it maybe the way that they needed to. So it got more draconian each day. So we're actually the only country in Europe, as I understand it, who are not allowed out to exercise. We can't go out for a walk. We can't go for a run, even if we go on our own. So we really can only leave the house to do the shopping and to walk the dog. And you cannot do it even if you're like a married couple. You can't go out together. You can only go out one at a time. So when they announced the state of emergency, it became very clear the central Spanish government out of Madrid said that they would be the authority. That has led to a lot of political bickering, arguing,
rightfully so or not, I don't know. I'll stay out of the politics. But the regions are, you know, questioning how much authority they should have. It's particularly difficult here in Catalonia. There were already political distances, we could say, between Madrid and Barcelona, and Catalonia as a whole as a region. We had political protests here just back in October, bad ones. Thousands of people took over the Barcelona airport in protest. They were burning things in the streets. So when Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez announced the state of emergency and announced that everything would be centralized under the central Spanish government, the regional authorities really were not very happy with that, particularly here in Catalonia. So like regional police are now answering to the central Ministry of the Interior. The health authorities, I believe, are still regional, but the centralized Spanish government can overrule their decisions if needed. On top of that, the central Spanish government has nationalized all the hospitals. So all the private hospitals are now at the disposal of the central government. And this past weekend, the central Spanish government told factories and businesses that they had 48 hours to announce to the government what capabilities they have in terms of manufacturing and what they can do to provide masks, to provide respirators and ventilators, and how they can change any manufacturing that they're doing to be able to contribute to the cause. I've seen online that they have been using drones in some places to go out and let people know that they need to go home, although I myself have not seen that or experienced that. You definitely have more law enforcement out on the streets. Starting today, at least in theory, here in Catalonia, we have to fill out a form. If we go out, we have to download it and fill it out, explaining where we're coming from, where we're going to, and why. So it's sort of a self-certifying explanation, so that if we are stopped, we need to, again, in theory, be able to show this to explain why we're doing whatever it is that we're doing. Where you see the disconnect, the central Spanish government said it's not obligatory. The regional Catalonia government said that it is. But in terms of technologies and watching GPS and smartphones and that type of thing, I haven't seen as much reporting on that as you're seeing in some other places. So they now can arrest you if you give them too hard of a time. But they're doing citations. So I heard from a neighbor that just a few days ago, somebody was out in the alley next to our building with a young kid, just letting the kid run around after a week of being cooped up. And the police stopped him and gave him a ticket. So I was out yesterday to go get food, and I passed several police, but nobody stopped me or asked me anything because I just was sort of going and coming. But I have heard stories of people who have been stopped because they're spotted too many times trying to get out. I believe that it's within the Spanish Constitution that once a state of emergency is declared, there are certain rules that go into effect that allow the central Spanish government to take control of certain measures. Again, I think the health authorities remain regional, but they've all been reporting their information back to the central health ministry. And again, you have to remember it's a kingdom, so the king has certain rights and legal authorities as well. The legal response has just been coming out from the prime minister and from the central government. And the king himself, he maybe signs off on the decrees, but he's mostly been a calming figure coming out to speak. However, again, that's where regional and domestic politics come into play. A few days ago, when the king spoke, everybody came out here where I live, at least in Catalonia. Everybody went out on their balconies to bang pots so that nobody could listen. Nobody could hear the king speaking. Generally, my friends here are mostly expats, although I do have a number of local friends as well. But sort of among my social circle, people are mostly, with a few exceptions, mostly pleased with how the central government has taken over. And I certainly feel in a moment of crisis that you need a centralized figure in authority to be making these types of decisions. Some Catalans, though, feel very differently, and they fear that this is, you know, an attempt by the central government to pull more power away from the regions, particularly from Catalonia, which has already, like I said before, experienced a deterioration of relations with Madrid. So the domestic politics, very much like what you're seeing in the U.S. right now, you know, the fights between the states and the federal government as to who should be doing what, only here we have sort of the inverse of it. The centralized government has come in and said, we will be the authority. We will be the main focus in this, in running this, the response to this crisis, and the regions pushing back and saying, no, we actually want a little bit more freedom in how we take our decisions.
Hi, I'm Brian. I'm a second year law school student at Yale Law School. Right now I'm in Seoul, Korea, where my family lives. So as of Tuesday night, I think we have about 9,000 cases in Korea. And at this point, I think the Korean government has officially announced that there are more recoveries than infections, additional infections. I think, had about 64 cases here yesterday, and 14 of those were actually from overseas, meaning that the number of additional infections here is actually even lower than the reported 64 cases per day. So it's definitely on the mend here, for sure. So the two pillars in South Korea's approach, I would say, have been two things, testing and tracking. The key difference between here and the United States is that you don't need to exhibit symptoms to get tested as long as you have ties to another confirmed patient or a potential site of contamination. So for instance, if you're flying in from Europe now, it doesn't matter who you are or what symptoms you have, you have to get tested. You will get tested no matter what at the airport. So they've made testing widely available to people for free, even foreigners early on, and have tested more than 300,000 people at this point. And that's about one in every 170 people, which is incredible. Secondly, they have implemented aggressive measures to track both patients and potential patients. So they're not only testing on an insane number of people, but those people they're testing are actually from a very statistically, scientifically probable pool of people with some indirect or direct ties to already confirmed patients. So the authorities here have been able to do this by, you know, accessing people's credit card histories, surveillance footage, cell phone geolocation data of confirmed patients to determine who they've been in contact with, where they've been, and from there mapping out, you know, who the potential new patients might be, and then aggressively testing those very specifically identified potential patients. So for instance, once the authorities found out that the famous patient 31 was a Shincheonji cult member, they started testing hundreds of thousands of people in that cult and identified thousands of patients within that cult in the early stages. So basically the two pillars are testing and tracking. And they kind of go hand in hand. They track who the potential patients might be, and then they test them aggressively. Hair salons are open. Restaurants are open. People aren't, like, hogging toilet paper. The government is rationing masks, so everybody has them. So there's general optimism here that we're through the worst and that we're nearing the light at the end of the tunnel. And I don't think that's what people are feeling in the United States. So it's been very ironic for me to have to come back to Korea, which only a few weeks ago was seen as this kind of new hotspot of disease, and the U.S. government had to impose a level 3 warning. Now the United States obviously has, I think, almost 5 times the number of cases, and New York City alone, I think, has more cases than all of Korea. So when I came back from the U.S., at the airport, I had to download this app that would kind of track my movement for the next 14 days. And I had to consent to that as I entered the country. They collected all of my personal information. And when I entered the airport, people who had symptoms were taken away to get tested immediately. I didn't have any symptoms, but given the situation, I was told to basically stay home and limit all my activities. I don't think that I was actually required to quarantine myself, but I think just given the fact that I have family members here, and especially my grandmother's in the hospital, so I didn't want to indirectly endanger anybody in the family. So I've been very serious about taking these quarantine measures. And self-reporting my symptoms to the government just in case things developed. And actually, today I found out that a flight attendant on my flight had actually tested positive for the coronavirus. So I actually scheduled to get tested for the coronavirus myself. And it was a very easy process. I just called the number that they gave me. It turns out there were three coronavirus testing centers nearby. I called one of them. They told me to come in the next 30 minutes. I went in, got tested within 3 minutes. And then 6 hours later, I got a text message on my phone saying that I was thankfully negative. So it's been a very, very easy process for me to get tested here. And I think that's basically been the pillar of South Korea's response to this disease, is to test and track. So I think for the most part, I can talk about my sister who is working here. She goes to work every day. There hasn't been a widespread kind of work from home order by the government. So people are able to go to work and take public transit. And as I said, I think the flip side of that is, you know, the government is able to track very specific groups of people. So then they don't have to issue these government shutdowns. So in a way, the complete shutdown that we see in the States or in Europe is perhaps what you get when the government isn't able to come up with a more narrowly tailored plan of attack based on advanced contact tracing technology. So in a way, it's like a less rigorous way of dealing with the outbreak. And in Korea, what we've seen is that they have been able to be more rigorous with the people that they target so that the rest of society can actually go on without being affected as much. That said, I think everybody here is taking general precautions like wearing masks and even gloves in public transit. So the general population here is actually definitely still practicing these basic precautions for sure. And so in response to the MERS outbreak here in 2015, the South Korean government actually developed a very specific legal regime to fight the spread of infectious disease. So Article 76(2) of the South Korean Infectious Disease Control and Prevention Act gives the Minister of Health authority to collect private data without a warrant from both confirmed and potential patients. And Article 34 also creates a disclosure requirement obligating authorities to then share this information about patient movement paths to the public so that members of the public can take precautions on their own. So this is why here, you know, I'm getting emergency texts like Amber Alerts in the US multiple times a day about new confirmed cases nearby. And the government has been able to invoke these authorities to go into people's cellular geolocation data and actually contact trace hundreds of thousands of potential patients without a warrant. Articles 47 and 49 of the same act also give the government authority to shut down any potential sites of contamination, including religious facilities. So the government has been able to shut down more than 400 religious facilities tied to the initial outbreak in the Shincheonji cult. So that's been very effective as well. And other authorities include the ability to prosecute people for breaking quarantine or refusing to get tested for the virus. And another authority that the government has invoked is a provision that allows them to take necessary means to produce masks and other medical supplies, which in the United States has been a problem, as we have seen. So I would say the South Korean legal regime for fighting an infectious disease is very highly specific. So I would say the South Korean government has highly specific legal authorities that the United States government does not have, mainly because the U.S. government has to fall upon state legislatures and state government and state laws to fight the disease at a more localized level. So I would say that people here are generally very satisfied with the government's response, especially as they see what's happening in Europe and the United States. I think there's like a sigh of relief here. On one hand, I think the Shincheonji cult where the outbreak began feels like they've been unjustly targeted. But on the other hand, I think the ability of the government to use technology to target very specific groups and networks of people is precisely why the rest of society has been able to just go on a kind of business as usual and stay open. Because one thing that people don't realize is that in South Korea, they haven't issued these general shutdowns that we've seen in the US. And the ability of the government to allow businesses to stay open and not declare these huge, you know, kind of wholesale shutdowns depended on its ability to just target and trace specific groups of people.
I am Giovanna De Maio. I'm a visiting fellow at the Center for United States and Europe at Brookings, and I come from Italy. So Italy now has been reported over 74,000 people in total who have been affected by COVID-19, of which there are at the moment over 7,000 deaths, but over 9,000 people who recovered. The fact that in the past few days, the contagion rate has decreased. Experts are saying that this is a sign of the fact that quarantine measures are actually proving effective, because you know that in order to see the effects of quarantine, it's usually about 2 weeks before you see a decrease in the contagion rate and also in the number of deaths. So the pandemic actually started around mid-February, say, at least it was reported around mid-February. And since basically the end of February, the government of Italy started implementing specific measures that were proportionate to the progression of the outbreak. So specifically from the lockdown of Codogno, which is a small village in the outskirts of Milan, where the whole pandemic started, the government went forward with a lockdown of bigger, the region of Lombardy and other provinces in the center north, with different measures, actually. There were at least at first closing schools, then encouraging people to teleworking, and then progressively getting to the point of closing all non-essential business. And then was expanded from Lombardy region and other provinces to the entire Italian peninsula, with the possibilities for regional governors that were recently allowed to even increase the level of quarantine measures on their own according to the needs of each region. So, for example, in the region of Campania, the region where Naples is and where also my family is from, the governor of that region, Vincenzo De Luca, he has been very much stricter in forbidding gatherings, but most importantly, forbidding people from leaving their house except for groceries or going to the pharmacies. So basically avoiding also jogging outside or taking walks outside. Even, for example, people were taking advantage of having a dog and, of course, walking the dog outside. Many people decided took longer breaks, stayed out for a while, for hours, or also walked much more farther away than their homes. And so the governor implemented those much more stricter regulations in terms of quarantine. Initially, of course, this is an unprecedented crisis, but I have to say that the Italian government has been adjusting quite a bit and also carefully consulting experts from the National Institute of Health, and so making decision according to this consultation with experts. On the coordination with regional authorities, basically at the beginning, regions tried to be more independent, like trying to push for measures that were not dictated by the center. So even regions that were initially not affected by coronavirus cases, that had not reported coronavirus cases, also started closing schools and limiting public transportation until the government stepped in and called everybody back to one centralized stream of power that would allow better coordination between the central government and each region. So I have to say, in initial phase, there was regions in especially in the south, but also in the north, that took measures for themselves, just without consulting the government. And then the government stepped in, and now it's all one stream of leadership. In these particular cases, the Constitution allows special powers for like emergency situation. And the tool that has been employed by the Italian government is the decree. It's called the decree of the prime minister. Basically, it's a flexible tool that there has been already three or four of these decrees that basically disciplined the lockdown, all the stages of lockdown. And the parliament has been definitely informed that the opposition parties have been playing an important role of checking on the government's action and calling for more action in some areas or denouncing what they thought it was not appropriate. But overall, the main body of decision making has been the executive, so the cabinet of ministers and the prime minister. So, as I mentioned earlier, the numbers are pretty dramatic, like show a situation that is extremely dramatic. So I think that people now are feeling, if at first they were pretty reluctant, then slowly they sort of understand how important it is to stay home and avoid the overwhelming of the national healthcare system, because that's the main issue that Italy has been experiencing. With such a high number of cases, there were not so many spots available in intensive care units, and therefore there has been also a shortage of lung ventilators and face masks. So the situation has been and it continues to be very stressful for the national healthcare system. And so in some regions, you are allowed also to go jogging outside. But recently, this has been restricted in many regions of Italy, especially in the south, where the national where the healthcare facilities are in much poorer conditions than in the north. So regional governors are feeling like more urged to prevent movement outside, and of course exceptions are made for those who provide essential services, so they need to go to work anyways. So for example, I can give you the example of my parents. My father is works for the regional railway service, a company, and he needs to go to work, and he has organized rotations with his colleagues. So he goes in for 1 week, and then the other so in basically two teams that don't overlap with each other. And versus my mom, she's a teacher and she's been teaching from home. So all the recording videos or like sharing homeworks with the kids from the internet. And she's allowed, like, as if you're home, you're allowed to go to the grocery store or to the pharmacy, but you're not supposed to stay out, of course, for long. There are police cars driving around the city to urge people to stay home, and people are usually need to take with them a self-certification that they can print from their computer and show that in case they are seen outside. But this was mostly in the beginning of this lockdown, because now people are mostly like just going to the grocery stores and not going anywhere else. This was when the shops were still open, some shops were still open, and you could also do something else rather than that. So now it's basically full lockdown. There has been, so for now, the police has been allowed to use drones to check on, actually monitor if there were public gatherings in some areas. So that's one tool. Some police stations have used cell towers to track where cellular phones were specifically, in order to see and check on people who were actually violating the lockdown. Some polls that were made by Utrend, and they showed a 71% approval rate for the government. So people really are Italian people are showing resistance to this, but also like a sense of togetherness. a lot of, like, there were over 11,000 volunteers who help with whatever could be assistance to old people or to delivery groceries or like pharmacy products. Also, like fundraising campaigns that allowed to build up a camp hospital outside Milan, because the one of the most hit cities is Bergamo, which is like 1 hour away from Milan. So I think like there has been like, I guess what was very important for Italian people was the high level of communication and transparency of the government. Like basically the way the Prime Minister Conte delivered his messages every day through Facebook Live, but also like different social media, also helped people not feeling like anxious about what was happening. Everything was very well explained with press conferences, so with journalists always asking questions. And so, of course, everything can be perfectible, and definitely not everything the government has done was like considered enough from like different point of view. Can be considered like not enough from different point of view. Some people say that the government should have proceeded with a lockdown faster than it actually did, that the government should have had plans for this pandemic, but it's very much unprecedented. And I think people are reacting in a very positive way by, you know, of course, you will see always people that violate the curfew, but overall, there is very much a sense of belonging and togetherness in this.
I'm Joshua Yaffa. I'm a correspondent for The New Yorker, and I live in Moscow. The overall awareness about coronavirus and the threat it poses to the world and to Russia specifically has come much slower here than I've seen it come the rest of the world. My mother in California, friends in New York, other friends in Paris, all of them were both nervous, and then much more than nervous, quite alarmed about the impending pandemic reaching them, and then taking measures to counteract that long before I saw similar action or similar awareness here in Russia. But here in Moscow, whether on the level of the state or the public, that awareness has been much slower in coming, and the countermeasures about how to protect society and individuals from coronavirus have also been slower in coming. But I should say the numbers, at least the official statistics about people infected with the virus, have also been much lower. So it just feels like everything is kind of slowed down, or rather, you know, on a bit of a delay here, that Russia maybe is, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, some people say, away from the kind of reach of the epidemic that we're seeing in Europe and the U.S., or maybe through some combination of luck and tactically smart countermeasures, Russia will avoid the kind of horrific scenarios we're seeing play out in places like Italy and in much of the U.S. I'm a bit worried that Russia's not doing enough. Someone who lives in Moscow, and now my kind of own health and the health of my family is a function of the measures being taken by the Russian authorities. I think there's some skepticism on my part and others about, are these kind of slowly ratcheting up measures going to be enough to prevent the coronavirus epidemic from hitting Russia hard or not? I think in a couple of weeks we'll know the answer, but it's definitely been a slow incoming and very step-by-step ratcheting up of measures and awareness about the danger of coronavirus driving those measures. There's been statistics that have come out in recent weeks that show a spike of about 37% in Moscow January to January, January 2020 compared to January 2019, of pneumonia cases in the city's hospitals. Of course, we can't say with certainty that that's coronavirus, but that's certainly where a lot of people's minds went. The same thing's playing out in a lot of regions around Russia. I talked to a man in Volgograd in southern Russia who himself had viral pneumonia earlier this year. And when he went to be treated at the hospital in Volgograd, doctors said to him that every second or third patient overall they were seeing at the hospital was a pneumonia sufferer. And that according to doctors in Volgograd, it felt to them like the rates were up 10 times compared to what they would see in a normal year. So it's definitely happening in Moscow because we have those statistics. It seems to be anecdotally happening in other regions, and there are some statistics from other regions in Russia that show that there are similar spikes in pneumonia cases this year compared to previous ones. But, you know, like everywhere, the problem is really testing. So in a place like Volgograd, you know, we may never really know the true reach of coronavirus. But certainly a lot of journalists and some epidemiologists saw something curious and maybe suspicious in that spike. The response has been really interestingly piecemeal and kind of scattershot, and that, you know, you think of Russia being this top-down place administered by the so-called vertical of power, with Putin at the very top issuing these commands that filter down throughout the bureaucracy, with Putin being the arbiter and ultimate authority. And coronavirus has interestingly called that into question a bit and show that either Putin doesn't necessarily want to take full unitary responsibility for this crisis, or doesn't exactly know how to. Maybe it turns out perhaps that he has this vertical of power is a less well-oiled machine than we thought, or he just doesn't exactly know how or doesn't want to use it. But in any case, we've seen Putin not exactly take a back seat, but certainly not be out in front and coming up with a very clear, coherent national policy on coronavirus. On Wednesday, it became clear that he was going to give an extraordinary address to the country. Myself, like a lot of journalists, tuned in to see what he would say. And it was kind of a squishy, milquetoast, not exactly very forceful address, where the measures about how the country would combat coronavirus were actually left kind of vague. The one thing he did say was that the next week in Russia would be a working holiday. People wouldn't go to work. Their salaries would be paid. But that's it. There was no mention of quarantine. There was no mention of people being forced to stay in their homes. And the only thing that Putin did offer in terms of specifics were various measures about raising taxes on various types of bank deposits and offshore transactions, things that might raise a bit of money, but also seem not exactly on the topic of coronavirus. It was then a day or so after that the Moscow mayor announced that during this week of holiday that Putin had declared for Russia in Moscow, all cafes, restaurants, shops, and parks would be closed. So not exactly forcing a home quarantine, but kind of in essence making the city inaccessible and not really functional for people, closing down all places where people might congregate or gather other than food stores and pharmacies, the kinds of measures we've seen in lots of European countries. And it was then a day after that, after the Moscow mayor announced that those would be the rules from Moscow, that the prime minister of Russia, a newly appointed technocratic figure who doesn't really have a lot of political visibility or legitimacy of his own, announced that actually it would be a good idea if the measures that the mayor of Moscow announced would apply to all of Russia. So in essence, 72 hours later, it did seem like Russia was headed toward more of a total or quasi-total shutdown than Putin had announced during his extraordinary address. And then making things all the more weirder and confusing, Putin's spokesperson on Friday said that this working holiday scheduled for next week actually wouldn't apply to people who are already working remotely from home. They would continue to work as usual. So the whole kind of flurry of activity of different figures announcing different measures, starting with Putin himself and then these other officials modifying that message in the days that followed, created the impression of an overall system that doesn't really know exactly what it wants to do, or isn't capable of speaking with one authoritative voice, which actually does interestingly complicate things in a broader sense of how we imagine this Russia to work. I've noticed a few interesting things happening in terms of the response of the public at large, and first and foremost, my friends, to the various coronavirus measures that have been announced. The first was after Putin had this rather fuzzy or not very forceful speech on Wednesday, where he announced a work holiday and nothing else, I actually noticed a lot of my friends, people who would be the most opposition-minded, liberal-minded people, otherwise anti-Putin, were really dismayed that he hadn't been tougher. It struck me as perhaps the first and only time in my memory that liberal Russians I know who otherwise oppose the Putin system actually wanted it to be harsher in its measures, wanted stricter rules coming down from the Kremlin. So that was a way that it seems clear the coronavirus is really scrambling politics and societies the world over, Russia included. More broadly, I'd say that Russian society has built up a kind of learned skepticism toward the authorities and to the various rules and edicts it offers. I wrote about this in a piece for The New Yorker this week about Russia's coronavirus response, that throughout the Putin era, there's been all manner of very repressive or restrictive laws in which the inconsequential is made equal with the consequential, and people see this and develop responses to it. And the response to it is essentially to ignore the laws, to constantly be trying to outsmart them, to develop kind of personal workarounds to them, to not take them seriously, because the laws themselves, as I say, combined the kind of important with the unimportant and are overly restrictive. And so people have learned to live their lives navigating around them. And I think that presents a problem here for the Kremlin in terms of its coronavirus responses. There isn't a lot of credibility in whatever the government says, okay, you must now do this. I think people are inclined to think, yeah, whatever, you know, the government tells us to do that, tells us to do this, it says we can't do that. We've spent 20 years or really even longer going back to the Soviet period of just coming up with our own workarounds, paying lip service to whatever edict comes from on high and then doing whatever it is we want. And that's a really deeply ingrained Russian behavior that potentially can have dangerous or certainly counterproductive implications in terms of coronavirus. I think if and when the Kremlin decides it wants to have a very strong and very coherent response to coronavirus, of course, there won't be any problem in articulating and implementing that, as we've seen with various machinations right now to change the constitution so as to allow Putin to run for a fifth and possibly sixth term. If something needs to be done and needs to be squished so as to fit according to the letter of the law, or to made to be seem to appear to fit the letter of the law, there's no problem for the Kremlin in engineering that outcome.
My name is Erin Bates. I'm a full-time law student, usually, but campus is in limbo at the moment because of the national lockdown here in South Africa. I'm based in the city of Cape Town, and I am also a freelance broadcast journalist with several years, both as a reporter and anchor in news in South Africa. 22 days ago, we had one confirmed case of coronavirus in South Africa, and while O.R. Tambo International Airport, for example, in Johannesburg is a nexus for a lot of travel to the rest of the continent and beyond, I think from what we've been hearing from some of our cabinet ministers, the sentiment was really that the concern was around South African citizens abroad who might be exposed to COVID-19. That over the last 22 days has dramatically shifted. And as things stand on the evening of Friday, the 27th of March, 2020, which, by the way, is the first day of our three-week national lockdown, we have 1,170 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the country. We have one confirmed fatality to date. And according to our Minister of Health, Dr. Zweli Mkhize, we have 55 coronavirus patients in hospital across the public and private sector, four of whom are in ICU, three of whom are on ventilators at the moment. So the whole issue of the national lockdown is quite a loaded question in democratic South Africa, because we're seeing members of the South African National Defence Force in fatigues on the ground along with our police service. And I think for many people who lived through the horrors of apartheid and states of emergency in this country, it's a very loaded and triggering seen. But what happened was our president, Cyril Ramaphosa, announced a national state of disaster, not emergency, and that's an important distinction, on about the 15th of March, on a Sunday evening, in a nationwide address to the country. Then, after about a week and a half, if not 2 weeks, things escalated, and he declared that this national lockdown of 21 days was looming. It came into effect on midnight of Thursday, that is into Friday morning, and we're in it now for the next 3 weeks. And so today we've begun to see those scenes of law enforcement officers with a mandate from our president, Cyril Ramaphosa, as commander-in-chief of the SANDF, to go and serve the people of the country against an invisible enemy. So there's quite a different framing around having the military in neighborhoods, in informal settlements and communities, but it's still quite a bizarre and unprecedented moment for constitutional democracy, South Africa post-1994. I was going through the first amended regulations. There's now a second amended regulations, Government Gazette, and the state has the power in terms of those regulations to enforce the admission of any bodily sample if a person suspected of having coronavirus, if they've been in contact with someone who has coronavirus, or they do indeed have coronavirus. It just struck me as kind of a weird and eerie addition to the regulations. I mean, in the hands of someone with no scruples, that could really be abused. So what's important here is that, and I think this has been quite a conscious step by Ramaphosa and his cabinet, is that they haven't declared a national state of emergency, which is loaded and harks back to the apartheid regime. This is a national state of disaster in terms of the Disaster Management Act of, I think it's 2002. And so he's acting within existing legislation. There's been emphasis both from Ramaphosa and our Minister of Justice, Ronald Lamola, of doing this within our constitutional framework. And so there seems to be, at least in the rhetoric coming out of our politicians, a consciousness around that. Having said that, there is a tension in terms of the kind of posture we're seeing from some ministers in the cabinet who seem quite gung-ho about the sort of immense powers they now have. So the national state of disaster has been declared by Ramaphosa in terms of our constitution of 1996. Then we've had a number of regulations. We had a first set of regulations which was signed by our Minister of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs, Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma. They go into all sorts of details about what constitutes essential goods, what constitutes essential services, what you can and cannot do during the lockdown. And we've since had an amendment of that. And it goes into the kind of minutiae of transportation, movement of persons and goods, the lockdown of national and provincial borders. I think everyone's in this kind of galaxy of emotions and responses to coronavirus. And one of the things that is so telling in South Africa is that we have many South Africans. So there are the chattering classes, there are the middle class who are holed up in fairly comfortable domestic spaces. And then we have a majority population of people who are eking out a livelihood at the best of times. So Ramaphosa, for example, in announcing the national state of disaster, highlighted his concerns about our state healthcare system and its capacity, or rather lack thereof, to manage widespread coronavirus outbreak. We have millions of people living with HIV and on antiretrovirals provided by the state. We have millions of people living with tuberculosis. These are people who take taxis, buses, trains, walk for miles, and then languish in queues for hours before they can get a basic healthcare checkup. So the stakes are really, really high here, but there does seem to be a degree of disconnect between those who are plugged in and perhaps quite literate about what's going on, and people who live in informal settlements, people who are living in shacks or very, very modest houses. And there is, at least for me, a concern about the gravity of the situation reaching the people who are most at risk. I will say, however, that I was quite heartened in a way, if you can be under the circumstances, when I saw a former colleague of mine reporting from the center of Johannesburg today, as they were, this is the authorities rounding up homeless people to go into shelters, which they can do in terms of the provisions under national disaster, in terms of the Disaster Management Act. And a very well-informed, jacked-up homeless person was expressing his concern at the fact that the queue was so close together. So we have in that anecdote an example of someone who is quite vulnerable, who's at risk, who lives on the streets, but who's also really clued up and is seeing right before him the difficulties in enforcing the regulations in terms of the national disaster and the lockdown, and also the issue of compliance. I mean, we're really not even into the proper sort of thrust and cut of the national lockdown. And I certainly have concerns about South Africa generally being quite a violent society and quite a rough life for most people, and how this is all going to play out. It's a great conundrum and a great mystery.
Hi, I'm Suzanne Maloney. I'm the Interim Vice President and Director of Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution, and I've been studying Iran for the past 25 years. As of Tuesday, March 24th, there were approximately 25 cases of COVID-19 that had been tracked in Iran. It's unclear if this number is fully accurate. There are a lot of expectations that, in fact, testing is not widely available or as widely available as it could be in Iran, and that the government has an incentive to avoid disclosing the full scope of the outbreak in Iran. Well, Iran was one of the early cases of outbreak. Shortly after the news began emerging from China about the scope and the severity of the outbreak there, there were early signs that Iran had been infected, most likely through travel between Iran and China, which is quite extensive due to the economic relationship between the two countries. The outbreak began apparently in the holy city of Qom, which is about an hour and a half south of the capital of Tehran. And it was quite severe even in the early weeks. There were cases reported early on that highlighted the impact on the leadership itself, a number of members of parliament, other mid-ranking and even senior officials who were either infected or in some cases actually succumbed to the illness of COVID-19. There does appear to be some evidence that the curve may be flattening at least a little bit within Iran. But again, I think that there's a real lack of clarity and confidence in the government statistics. And given that the Iranian government has not successfully, at least until this day, begun to implement a significant lockdown on travel and movement around the country, there are expectations that, in fact, the virus and the outbreak in Iran is going to spread much further than it already has. Early on, officials from the Iranian Health Ministry were advocating for a curtailment of travel between Iran and China. That first description or the first apparent request for a curtailment of travel between Iran and China may have happened as early as late January. But in fact, that wasn't the case. The government, in fact, downplayed the severity of the crisis during its first several weeks, even as more and more evidence began to emerge of infections and even of serious cases and death. That was partly, I think, a response to the need to organize elections, which were held for the Iranian parliament, and the fear that if, in fact, any kind of awareness of the severity of the crisis was acknowledged by the government, that there would be pressure on Iranians to stay away from the polls. And that's an important legitimizing event for the Iranian system. Shortly after those elections, the government began taking a more proactive and public position to try to encourage individuals to stay home, to try to deploy a much wider array of testing and self-isolation for individuals who had either been exposed or who had contracted the illness. But it's been quite clear all along that this has been insufficient to handle the scope of the outbreak because it was allowed to spread so widely in its early days. the Iranian medical system has found itself greatly overwhelmed. Obviously, all of these challenges in Iran are compounded by the fact that Iran is subjected to significant economic sanctions, which impede the flows of almost all financial transactions. And while they don't apply to purchases or trade in pharmaceuticals or medical equipment, they have, of course, as a result of impeding banking transactions, they've made it more difficult for Iran to stock up on the materials that would be needed, as well as the medicines that would be needed to try to fight this outbreak. And so really just this week, a week after the Iranian New Year, the Iranian leadership has announced that they are going to try to impose greater restrictions on travel around the country. I think that's very much too little too late, because hundreds of thousands of Iranians have been on the roads even in the past few days, traveling as is part of the kind of traditional response to or traditional activities around the Iranian New Year holiday. The government is, in fact, capable of imposing greater control over movement of people and opening of businesses and this sort of thing. There's been an aversion to do so for a variety of reasons, apparently a concern about a public backlash because of the economic hardships that Iranians are already facing, again, partly as a result of sanctions, partly as a result of the government's own mismanagement of the economy. And that for that reason, there has been a reluctance to really try to achieve a strict quarantine to prevent the outbreak from spreading further. One of the interesting aspects about the Iranian experience with coronavirus is the extent to which it's been intertwined with both the economy, but also with the religious power structure in Iran. Iran's government is one that claims legitimacy as a result of its religious nature. It is at least in part a theocracy. And this outbreak began in and around the seminary city of Qom, where there are important shrines that many Iranians visit. The government had difficulty even trying to close those shrines, which it did very late in the crisis. And in fact, hardline seminary students broke in and tried to overcome the closure of the shrines because they considered this heretical. So there are a number of challenges that the Iranian government is facing, both economic, social, and religious, in trying to stem the tide of this outbreak and try to avoid the worst consequences for the country. I think there's been a lot of frustration from within Iran. Obviously, I'm speaking from Maryland, and I'm gauging that via social media and other forms of communication with Iran. But there's been a sense on the part of many Iranians that the government has been disorganized, reluctant to do what was necessary, and that, you know, fundamentally, this is a crisis that the government has helped to fester. There were many within the senior leadership who early on in the crisis were deriding how significant this was. There's still a fairly evident effort on the part of the Iranian leadership to circulate disinformation, to describe the coronavirus as an American orchestrated either hoax at the outset or now an American orchestrated weapon. The leadership has also publicly rejected American offers of assistance, and most recently, apparently, rejected an effort on the part of the group Doctors Without Borders to set up a small hospital that might have assisted deployed on the ground in Iran. And so, you know, I think that there is, Iranians have suffered a great deal over the course of the past 41 years since the Iranian Revolution. They've been through a war, they've endured innumerable natural and man-made disasters, experience with terrorism and invasion and tremendous hardship. But this is a crisis which is both economic and one that is obviously very much a public health crisis. And it comes at a time when the Iranian leadership has, I think, experienced a significant reduction in its internal legitimacy, both as a result of the crackdowns on successive efforts to voice anti-government views, as well as just the general sense that this aging leadership is no longer able to govern effectively over a country with a disproportionately young population. And so it comes, I think, the crisis of coronavirus for Iran comes at a time where the social fabric has frayed, where the economy is already under severe pressure. And I think it's a real question as to what it will mean as the government tries to mobilize a response, tries to outflank and outlive this crisis, this latest crisis. We don't really know how it's going to impact Iran for the long term, other than it's going to be devastating on the population and catastrophic for an already strained economy. There are many Iranians who have stayed off the streets, despite the fact that the government hasn't imposed a strict quarantine until very recently. Many Iranians have foregone some of the traditional celebrations around the new year. There have been, efforts to find other ways to engage virtually. And so it has been, even the kind of one of the preceding events to the Iranian New Year, a holiday called Chorshanbe Suri, when Iranians typically gather in their own backyards or in the streets to jump over fire to mark the passing of the old and the start of something new and fresh, had to be done in some cases electronically or virtually. And so, it is the tragedy of coronavirus is that it has, sucked away some of the simple pleasures of life. And it has obviously had a tremendous impact on the medical infrastructure and on the economy as a whole.
I'm Sophia Yan. I'm the China correspondent for The Telegraph, a newspaper in the UK, and I'm also the official pianist for the Lawfare podcast, and I'm sitting here in Beijing. So as of today, on March 26th, the Chinese authorities have reported over 80,000 infections in China and more than 3,200 deaths. If you look at the numbers that the Chinese health authorities have reported, things are definitely getting better. The numbers are subsiding, but there's a concern that they don't accurately reflect the scale of the outbreak, and that's because a couple of weeks ago, how the government decided it would count confirmed cases was changed. And almost immediately after, the numbers began to fall. Now we're seeing this outbreak in other countries, in Italy and throughout Europe and the UK, the US, and these other countries, Italy and Spain now have surpassed, their death tolls have surpassed that of China's. What's interesting about Italy in particular is that Italy's population is about the size of Hubei province's population. And so how could it be that these two parts of the world have such vastly different numbers? I mean, Italy's death toll is more than double what China has. From the beginning, there wasn't a lot of messaging around what was going on or what was happening, or even the sense that there was a health risk at hand. When the public really did finally find out, it was late January when the city of Wuhan, which is the epicenter of the outbreak, was completely locked down, outbound traffic blocked. And then that spread across the province and into other parts of the country. And so it was in that moment, this just complete shutdown of transport and people, the mobility and movement of people. I mean, that's really when these measures started to be instituted on a wide scale. And since then, we've seen this happen in different areas, different compounds in cities and villages. Housing compounds have instituted their own rules, for instance. You have to have a pass to come in and out. Even office complexes have done the same. There are body temperature checks everywhere you go, even now. And there's paper registration sometimes of personal details. And now they're moving towards these mobile apps where you can scan a QR code and that will tell you what your health risk is, what your contagion risk is. The only problem is there's not much transparency about who's getting this information about you or who has access to it and exactly what makes you, quote unquote, healthy with a green code or not healthy with a red code. In the beginning, everything was shut down. The roads were totally empty. I mean, Beijing's a city of more than 20 million people. I've never seen this city this quiet ever. And even in other cities, when I was traveling around when the outbreak first began to do stories, it was the same. I mean, cities that you normally would never, ever, ever be able to hear the birds chirp or notice anything kind of beyond the traffic and the hustle and bustle. I mean, all of a sudden, it was just empty. Over the last few weeks, things are starting to pick up. You can feel that the traffic is coming back. All of a sudden, I'm running late for things again. And people are coming out. They're walking in the parks. They're going out to see the sun and just get a bit of air. Everyone's been cooped up inside for the last few months, and restaurants and shops are starting to open. But in terms of getting around, there's still a lot of tracking of where people are going. I mean, you can't go anywhere without giving up personal information. And that's because the authorities think that if they do find someone who tests positive later on for the virus, that they can go back and try to track all the people that that particular person may have come in contact with. In the beginning, definitely, there was a lot of fear about what was going on, because there's a memory of what happened here 20 years ago with the SARS outbreak, when the government really very much covered up what had happened. And so many, many more people, I mean, what the government did then exacerbated the outbreak potentially. And something of that scale has happened again now. In the beginning, there was a lot of silencing of whistleblowers, and there was censorship of comments online. I mean, there were all sorts of things that the government was trying to suppress in terms of news and information, from basic public health messaging, and also things like the fact that hospitals were almost immediately overwhelmed by the influx of patients that were coming in sick. So there was a lot of move by censors to scrub the internet clean of this and to just keep people from talking to the press. This is sort of normal in China. It's like normal, just how they operate, the ruling Communist Party in many ways. But this is a public health crisis, where this, where how the government reacts can have impact on the world. And that's what we see now. So over time, there was a lot of anger and frustration and a lack of confidence, it seems, in what the government was doing. Over time, that's begun to change, partly because the propaganda messaging has been so strong. In early February, a young doctor who was only 34 years old, who was one of these whistleblowers, and he'd been punished by police, but he died from the virus. And there was just this huge outpouring of sadness and anger and grief from people. And after that, that was really sort of the peak that was felt here in China. And after that, you know, in the time since, the government's really ramped up its hero-making machine, as we often describe it, you know, showing stories of frontline nurses and doctors working overtime and just all these amazing stories of sacrifice and devotion on the front lines. And so that started to kind of galvanize a bit of the patriotic nationalist sentiment and the spirit here that, yes, China, you know, we're in it together, we're in the fight together. The leader of the Communist Party, Xi Jinping, called it the quote, People's War. And so now, to the present day, you see messaging and the sentiments in the public, you know, that China has turned a corner, that China has been successful. And in fact, it's done so well in fighting the coronavirus and it's begun helping other countries. China is selling supplies, medical supplies to Europe, to the US, to other nations who, or they're offering it at the very least to other nations who may need it. In some cases, they're saying they're donating them when they're actually selling them. And also conveniently glosses over the fact that part of the reason some countries in Europe are needing these supplies is because they had donated so many to China back in January and February when the country was dealing with the worst of the outbreak. So right now, China's been trying to paint itself as the leader in virus response and this global emerging savior. You know, look at us, we did so well, learn from us. And this is their way of trying to push soft power, essentially, to use this moment when the world is in crisis to show, hey, we're here and we can try to support. And this is in many ways what countries should be doing when the world is grappling with an emergency, essentially. And it's something that plays really well at home for the Chinese. This is yet another example of the might of the Chinese nation. And so it's one that they can look quite fondly upon and are very proud to have. A lot of people definitely feel confident and proud of what China's been able to do. I mean, they otherwise wouldn't be coming outdoors if they didn't think that the health risk had subsided enough that they could try to go back to a bit of normal life. A lot of people are kind of itching to go back anyway to their jobs. But there's a seed of doubt still that seems to nag at the public, because the numbers are almost maybe too good to be true. I mean, there's just, it's a very interesting way to be here, because you've got a country of 1.4 billion that's been told their whole lives the government's got their back, that they know best for its people, that everything will be fine. But there have been many incidents like SARS and again with this current pandemic where that hasn't always proven to be the case. And so there's like a nagging seed of doubt that you can feel when you're talking to people about what they think of what has happened, because people still remember, you know, this whistleblower doctor I mentioned, people still remember that he tried to warn about what something afoot and got in trouble for it. So this is something that people have some sense of. And because of that, it's hard in many ways for them to completely let go and just believe and trust the government. But this is also an environment where it's very dangerous to make that clear.
This is Amanda Slota, Robert Bosch Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. I lived in the UK for 7 years and continue to study all things British. The virus is starting to spread in the UK. The UK has been an outlier in Europe in terms of the pace of the virus spreading and also in terms of the government's response. If you remember way, way back to March 12th, when President Trump announced the suspension of all travel from Europe to the United States, he very specifically excluded the United Kingdom from this, which raised a number of questions about whether the UK was handling this better and why that exclusion happened. Within a couple of days, the virus began spreading more in the UK, and the UK and Ireland were added to the US travel ban as well. Now, Britain took a very different attitude from some of its European neighbors. You have a prime minister in Boris Johnson who tends to have a much more libertarian approach. The country has just gone through this Brexit experience and is seeking to carve out its own path separate from where the European Union is. But all of that said, the government was still closely following the advice of its scientific advisors. Its scientific advisors were just taking a slightly different approach. In particular, they were focusing on behavioral science, on how people react. And in particular, they were concerned that if many of the restrictions that we have seen in other countries, and that in fact have now been imposed in the UK as of March 24th, that people would get fatigued. So if they were locked down too early, at the moment when the crisis actually peaked, they feared that people would no longer comply with them. The other issue they focused on was this idea of herd immunity, wanting to get a large number of people a little bit sick to develop broader immunity to the disease rather than having to lock down the entire country. The British government followed this policy for a while, despite getting a large amount of political criticism from various citizens, as well as skepticism from their European neighbors. And finally, on March 24th, Boris Johnson announced a national lockdown, which included provisions that are very similar to other ones that we have seen in Europe in particular, in terms of closing offices, closing everything except for essential shops, and only allowing people to leave their house for essential work, for grocery shopping, and a very limited amount of exercise done alone. Opinion has been divided within the UK in terms of what the government's response has been. Initially, in talking to some friends anecdotally, they seemed able to point to the government's scientific rationale and thought that it made a certain amount of sense. Other people were very critical of the government's response, accusing them of being far too slow, of over-relying on behavioral science, and also making decisions based on pretty significant assumptions, particularly in terms of when the virus would peak, and also being willing to accept a certain number of deaths as you move toward herd immunity. And so, in general, there seems to be a welcoming of the restrictions that the government has put in place, although at the same time, human nature being what it is, you also have a large number of people who are unhappy with not being able to go out, parents now struggling to find childcare for their kids in terms of going to work, and people wanting to be able to continue to leave the house to exercise and do other things. And so public reaction has been somewhat mixed. I think some of the after effects of Brexit have also played into this as well, in terms of some people looking at what the European Union was doing and wishing that the UK was part of a coordinated response. Other people, I think, pointing to the idea that Britain was now regaining its ability to handle things on a national level, notwithstanding that that's the case for a lot of EU members, but really pointing to Britain's ability to do things differently.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Amanda Sloat, Radek Sikorsky, Alex Finley, Brian Kim, Giovanno DeMeo, Joshua Yaffa, Aaron Bates, Suzanne Maloney, and Sophia Yan. And, most of all, thanks to Jen Pachyahal, who is the producer of this week's podcast, as always. Your music is performed by Sophia Yan. Please rate and review the Lawfare Podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to share it widely on Twitter. And as always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.